Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it on social media. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds. Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. That means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it shows. Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. So, Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it, but it's perfect for those with those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold. Hot flashes and night sweats, racing thoughts and low moods, poor sleep and feeling tired all the time, occasional bloating and gas, no desire to be in bed next to someone, if you know what I mean. Yeah, Hormone Harmony can help with all of these things. And the biggest benefit, feeling like myself again. And that's what women mention over and over in the reviews. There are over 17,000 reviews for Hormone Harmony. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use our code, which is the acronym of the podcast, TSNOTYAW, at checkout. That's the podcast acronym at checkout at happymammoth.com.
Calling all memoirists. I'm so excited to let you know that I've put together an incredible all about memoir lineup for Saturday, the 11th of May from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, in which six amazing speakers guide you through everything you need to know to write a memoir that will sell. You'll get opportunities to ask questions of best-selling memoirists while also standing a chance to have your query letter live critiqued during the webinar. To see the awesome lineup and to register, go to biancamaray.com. There's an early bird promotion for the first 50 delegates who sign up. Come and join us and get your memoir groove on. Hi there and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest. Hi, Carly and Cece. Let's dive into today's Books with Hooks. Cece, why don't you get us started with the first query letter?
All right. Dear Ms. Waters, I am seeking representation for my upmarket novel, The Bittersweet Spot, complete at 95,000 words. The novel is a late-stage coming-of-age story following Latina protagonist Callie Cruz as she questions her muted identity years after her transition from attorney to stay-at-home mom. Your recent tweet beautifully captures Callie's central struggle, accepting that, quote, you can love your children and love the deepest parts of your mind that your child can never know, end quote. The book also fits your hashtag MSWL request for a unique take on motherhood and identity and call for plus-sized heroines. Fans of I Don't Know How She Does It and The Overdue Life of Amy Byler will appreciate Callie's quirky, honest, and at times achingly sad attempt to reconcile motherhood and selfhood. Callie sets out on a comedic yet poignant journey of self-discovery after her five-year-old son's type 1 diabetes diagnosis and her father's sudden death. She confronts a growing disconnect from her husband and attraction to her handsome priest and tries to recalibrate her personal and professional goals in the face of motherhood. She awkwardly turns to her son's pediatrician, also a type 1 diabetic, for advice on how to handle her inappropriate crush and unraveling life. Although he's initially reluctant to move beyond the doctor-patient boundary, their relationship evolves from medical guidance and snarky banter into an unexpected yet endearing friendship. But Callie ultimately realizes she alone must choose her path, pursue her attraction for her priest, save her marriage, or make a different choice entirely. The Bittersweet Spot provides a lighter look at perseverance in the face of pandemonium and offers an inspiring view of marriage, motherhood, caretaking, beyond martyrdom. Callie's unique voice, growth trajectory, and multi-layered friendship with her pediatrician offers the novel series potential as a modern-day Anne of Green Gables. I was published in The Archive, Duke's Literary Magazine, and the Duke Journal of Comparative and International Law, and more recently have written multiple essays featured on Scary Mommy. Thank you for considering my query. I hope to hear from you soon. Best regards, JC.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, CC. Okay, Carly, that was addressed to you. So why don't you tell us what you think?
Yeah, I thought they did such a good job. I love that opening paragraph. Obviously, it's full of flattering compliments and quotes of my tweet. So, you know, I get to pat myself on the back with that one and, you know, feeds into my ego. And I thought they did a really good job of making that very modern, had all of the MSWL mentions, my tweet, and some comps I think that are great. I don't know how she does it. It was a book, and then the movie with Sarah Jessica Parker, and The Overdue Life of Amy Byler was a book that came out a few years ago. So I know both of those comps. So, you know, obviously I'm the right person for this. And I thought the title was great. The word count could be on the long side, but, you know, it's under 100. So I think that's reasonable. The next paragraph is the kind of the content paragraph in terms of the plot itself. So I thought this was pretty well done. I mean, being able to get your whole plot into one paragraph is tough. So I appreciate that this person did that. The only thing I'm a little bit confused about is the handsome priest part. You know, I don't know too much about priestly relationships and religion and if priests are even allowed to have relationships. Like, I don't know too much about that. Cece's giving me a big no. So I'm a little bit confused about, like, by mentioning that you are attracted to somebody who is so unattainable, like, is that really a plot driver? So I was just a little, like, you know, not too sure about that. But overall, I think the unlikely friendship angle between the mom and the doctor, I think, is really interesting as well. Like, she's also trying to achieve an unattainable friendship because doctors aren't supposed to cross that kind of patient, you know, doctor confidentiality kind of border, right? And so I think it's so interesting that this character is, like, not only trying to attain something unattainable in their romantic life, but also in their friendship life. So I have a lot of questions about this plot and how much trouble this mom is going to get herself into, because she's kind of setting herself up for some trouble. And then we get into the last paragraph here, talking a little bit about some themes, some more comp. So I was a little bit confused by the Anne of Green Gables comp, because we had our comps up at the top, you know, for fans of I Don't Know How She Does It and The Overdue Life of Amy Byler. I wasn't too sure on why we had this modern day Anne of Green Gables comp. So I would just probably strike that through. And the series potential, like most upmarket fiction isn't really something that has series potential. So I was a little bit confused on why we felt this book needed series potential. So I would just pitch it as a standalone. The only books that really, especially in upmarket fiction, that get sequels are extremely successful books in terms of, like, you know, we're selling hundreds of thousands of copies kind of thing. So, you know, I think it's a little bit of a lofty goal, especially at this stage, not saying you can't do it. You know, I'm all for everybody shooting their shot and, you know, going for their dreams and laying it out there. But I just don't think in the query level, that is a great idea. So other than that, you know, I think it's a pretty sound query, follows the three paragraph structure, and clearly this character is going to get into some trouble. So overall, I think it's pretty good.
Yeah, there's certainly going to be an interesting character arc here. And, you know, Fleabag did the whole priest thing really, really well. So maybe, you know, people are wanting more of this content. Cece, what do you think?
I really enjoyed this query letter. It's very well written, very well structured. You can tell that the writer spent a lot of time putting it together. If I had to give her notes, like, the personalization is just wonderful. Whenever I see someone, like, referencing a tweet that I put out, or Carly or anyone else, I'm always like, well, this person's really paying attention. So that's always great. In terms of the plot, like the second paragraph, right, that covers the plot, I haven't read enough of her work to know this for sure, but I'm guessing that there's a lot of drama that happens. Like, falling in love with the priest is a major taboo subject, and I am all for taboo subjects in fiction. I don't know what this says about me, but I think it's very exciting. So I would perhaps try to include a bit more plot points into the plot paragraph and remove some of, like, the inner struggles. Right now, it reads like it's all in her head, meaning, like, all of the struggles, all of the conflict, it's just the desire in her head. And don't get me wrong, wrong, that can be a powerful thing. But I'm guessing, because it's upmarket, that there's probably a lot of actual things that happen as opposed to just inner struggles. So I would try to include a few more plot twists and plot points in that paragraph, just to give us a little bit more drama without giving too much away.
Perfect. Thanks, Cece. Okay, Carly, what did you think of those opening pages?
We start off the scene first thing in the morning with his mom, kind of cuddled in bed with some children. We have three kids kind of watching cartoons at 7:40 in the morning. We're given a time stamp. So I felt like we're falling into a couple trope really early, which is the waking up in the morning trope, and then like just telling us a lot of fact kind of thing. So we start off, you know, I'm a stay-at-home mother to three children, Landon, age 7, Ernie, age 5, Lizzie, age 3. You know, Ernie's named after my great-grandmother, Ernestine, and Lizzie after my mother, Elizabeth. That's just a lot of facts, you know? I just didn't really understand why we needed to kind of lay it out like that. There's just so many other ways to do it. And, you know, this is all information we can tuck in later. For example, like the stuff about the age, by saying they're in bed watching cartoons, like we already have an idea that like they're young children, right? So little things like that you can build in through the actual scene itself. You don't have to spell it all out. And things like, you know, I'm a stay-at-home mother, you know, you could tuck that in another way, saying like, oh, you know, I haven't worked for X number of years or something like that. Just, you know, fit it in a different way and not a telling way. He also had another kind of hell moment, which was, you know, talking about the dynamic with the husband, which is they feel bad for poor sweet Richard having to tolerate my antics, but that's always been our dynamic. He respects that I'm vocal and I wouldn't be married to him if I didn't. And Landon's my only child named after no one, which suits him perfectly. So all of these things, like we could do it through dialogue, through action, through so many other things that I just don't think we need to kind of spell it out. Like, especially since the husband's not there in that scene. Like, I don't know why we need to even bother with the husband right now. Like, let's just focus on, as Cece says, getting to the tension. So then we're getting into like a medical moment. The mom's just upset about the kid being up all night and being sick and that sort of thing. So they're off to the doctor. And there was a really beautiful line that I just wanted to highlight, because I always like to pull out some lines that I really like. The line was, while Ernie sits on my lap, his arms loosely around my neck, his heart beating with mine like it did for all of those months he lived in my body. I just thought a really sweet line I wanted to highlight. And then we kind of cut to the doctor stuff. So I liked this, like we're building this banter here. I thought that it could have been a little bit more clear that we are engaging in banter. I wasn't, again, because I read the queer letter, I get that, you know, there's going to be maybe a friendship here, but I would have really liked to kind of understand this banter. Again, we're doing a lot of telling, like he's Canadian and I mock him for the oot and a boot, which I'm sure everybody hears my Canadian accent whenever I'm speaking. I'm sure Bianca gets messages about that. Yeah. And just like, instead of the telling us that you're mocking, like show us through the banter that we're doing mocking, like even though she's in an intense dramatic situation, concerned about her son's health. I don't know. I just felt like we could have done a lot more through plot and in being in scene and through dialogue. And I think that would have just made this lie a little bit faster and for us to kind of get a better sense of what's going on a little bit quicker. So I think there's tons of potential here. It's like, you know, I'm being really nitpicky, but I really think that banter should just feel a little bit more natural, because a lot of times I feel like the author leads with the banter and then explains the banter, which I think we just don't need to do that. Another example is the doctor says, breathe, Callie Cruz, this isn't your fault. And right away I'm like, well, why is he calling her Callie Cruz? And then, you know, she explains like, oh, this is why he calls me Callie Cruz. So again, explaining that through the banter, I think would be a little bit better. Or even like a nurse coming into the room and like, you know, and in a third person, we can kind of like see how the banter happens that's separate from the nurse. Do you know what I mean? To try and create that dynamic through scene. So again, tons of potential here, a lot of drama, you know, we're concerned about the son's health. So I think we have a lot of potential, but I would just kind of tidy up the show versus tell and just make it a little clear, like where the banter is.
Yeah, that show versus tell is just so, so important. And I feel like the show versus tell and the mistake that's been made in terms of showing witty banter and then explaining witty banter, I feel like all of this just comes from a lack of confidence. And this is where we just need to trust ourselves more as writers. Just trust that our dialogue is showing that it's witty banter and that we don't have to tell these things. And showing young children in bed early in the morning watching cartoons, then that becomes trusting our reader to be able to join the dots and be able to understand what that situation is. And it's something that I still do to this day. So don't feel bad if this is something that you're doing. It's just something we need to guard against. Cece, your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are your thoughts, because you're in my head. Like when you mentioned the, you have to trust yourself and you have to trust your reader, I was going to go on this explanation about how these two things are actually connected, but you did that already. So yeah, I really liked the pages. I did think there was a lot of over-explaining. This is like very chatty and very engaging with the reader. She almost breaks the fourth wall and talks to us. And that's great. That's very voicey. That's in keeping with the genre, but you don't need to over-explain, because the reader reader is intelligent and the reader will get it. And more importantly, you're intelligent and you should trust your writing. So like an example is when right on the first page, she mentions that she searched the internet and type 1 diabetes was the first thing to pop up, but then her pediatrician assured her that slight weight loss was fine. So this is told in narration. And then immediately we see the dialogue, kind of like a very mini flashback of her asking the pediatrician, but you already told us that. We don't have to see it, right? So I would remove those lines with that mini flashback. There's a lot that's working really well here. The line where she says that every sick child is someone's sweet boy or girl. The line where she refers to the pediatrician as my pediatrician. Have you noticed that all moms do this? Like the pediatrician is the child's pediatrician, but all moms say my pediatrician because your child is your heart that's walking around, right? Like outside your chest. So of course you would do that. The part where she says like she eats real food like me, referring to June, the receptionist, I believe. And that was just great. And obviously I thought that like the whole Mrs. Asole comment was really funny. And I really like so much here. I just think that honestly, this could be like one page in terms of like, if you cut the over-explaining as well, do we have to start like with her waking up, like to build on Carly's comment, like about the trope, the waking up trope? Like, I don't know. I feel like we could maybe even start with her in the hospital. And then like, if the pediatrician is essential to the story, and obviously based on the query letter, he is, he could be there or he could be on the phone, or she could be like, how come he's not here yet? I don't know. I just, the backstory that it really is diabetes and she was right and nobody believed her could be inserted with like two carefully placed lines. And then we could be in the hospital already seeing like more action. Because I do think that given the genre, it's really important that it's jam-packed with like interesting and intriguing and just very action-filled plot.
Thanks so much, Cece. Okay, Carly, would you like to read our next query letter?
Absolutely. Here we go. Dear Bianca, Carly, and Cece, thank you for creating your wonderful podcast, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I only discovered it recently and I love it already. I'm glad to have the opportunity to submit my query in the first 5 pages of my novel, Suicide in Cold Blood, for your review and critique. It's a traditional mystery complete at 84,700 words. When 23-year-old Julia Haven was accepted into a college-sponsored accounting internship with Jungensfeld Industries, she was sure she was on her way. 3 months later, she was dead. The police ruled it a suicide. 4 days after being notified of Julia's death, registered nurse Beatrice Haven receives a note her daughter wrote on the day she died. When Beatrice reads it, she is convinced Julia was murdered. Outraged and devastated, Beatrice goes after her daughter's killers. The police have closed the case, so they won't help her. Alone, she sets out to take on Jungensfeld and anyone else who had a hand in Julia's death. Before she's through, two more people will die, and it soon becomes terrifyingly clear that if she doesn't drop her investigation, so will she. It's the motion picture Eye for an Eye meets Kimberly McCrae's novel Reconstructing Amelia, with a dash of corporate corruption and international intrigue. I am an affiliate member of Mystery Writers of America and have attended several writers' conferences, including the 2019 NY Pitt Conference and the Cincinnati Writers' Workshop, also in 2019. I'm also a grandmother and lover of roses, homemade bread, red wine, and chocolate. I figure if I have to get my antioxidants, I might as well enjoy it. I genuinely hope that you fall in love with Beatrice. I did. Thank you for your time, and I'm looking forward to hearing from you. Sincerely, Linda.
Awesome. Thanks, Carly. Cece, what did you think?
So again, this is a very well-written query letter. Clearly, this author put a lot of thought into it. So okay, notes. I would move the line with the comps to the first paragraph, right after 84,000 words, which by the way, you can just round up to 85. So she mentioned that Julia was murdered, right? And having read the pages, I understand that she thinks Julia was murdered by the company. So I would add that, like she's convinced Julia was murdered by the company, just so that the second paragraph makes sense. As well, and this is in part because I have read the pages, this query letter makes me think that we're going to start with Julia's story, that the first POV I'm going to get is Julia's, and it's not, it's Beatrice. And I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that Julia won't even feature in the story since in the beginning she's dead, unless we like go back in time. So I would just try to find a way to start the query letter, the second paragraph, the plot paragraph, with Beatrice. She's our hero. She's our protagonist. I'd like to be invested in her journey as early as the query letter, right? Like, I think that's important. So it's really just a rewrite, which I'm guessing will be like time consuming, but easy to do in terms of like, if Beatrice is your hero, you know everything about her. I would also try to add a line, because again, I don't know enough about the story, but in a good mystery, it's never only about who did it, right? Or even why they did it. A good mystery is interesting because when you go on that journey, other secrets are revealed, other things that have to do with that, with the killing, but there are also unrelated. So I would try to add a a line about that, right? About the secrets that are unraveled, about the world that starts to crumble around her. Because of course, it's very high stakes that maybe Beatrice's life could be in danger, but it should also affect her world. It should affect, I don't know, the town or the company or someone else, right? I want to see that effect, that like a bomb going off and like the ripple effect that everything is touched by this murder and her investigation. So yeah, these are my notes.
Awesome. Thanks, Cece. Carly?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good analysis. The other thing I think you hit on, which was important, was, yeah, whose story is this? Who does it belong to? Who's going to be telling it? So I assumed it was a dual POV, because with a comp like reconstructing Amelia, that is a dual POV comp. You know, it's pretty clear. Like, if you're going to use that comp, it's a dual POV, like a mother telling the story, a daughter telling the story. There's a murder. There's a mystery. And so I definitely thought it was a dual POV. So that's interesting that we're not sure whether it is or not. So I would make that very clear. I like what Cece was saying about how does this implicate the community or the city or the town. I really, really like that. Like, absolutely everybody. I'm obsessed with Mayor of Easttown. So I've been talking about it on Instagram. Like, who do you think did it? By the time this podcast comes out, it'll be next week and we're going to know who did it. You guys can all laugh at me. But yeah, I'm obsessed with just, yeah, that like a community feeling and how a murder or a mystery really affect everybody else and has that ripple effect. I think that's really, really important. I think the title is going to turn some people off. Suicide in Cold Blood. I think it's tricky, especially when you're comping, again, reconstructing Amelia. It's such like a women's suspense, or, you know, women's fiction suspense, domestic, like it was one of the first domestic suspense novels, arguably. So yeah, I think that title's really, really tricky. I don't have a better one for you yet, but the word suicide is triggering, you know, in Cold Blood. Again, that's murder. So I understand what you're trying to do. You're trying to juxtapose suicide versus murder, but it's a triggering title. And I think it's going to be problematic. So I would definitely just start with a new one. And I was a little bit confused by the company name. Like, so it's spelled out like Young and then the letter N and then Svelte. So Young and Svelte Industries. I couldn't really tell if this was like ironic or trying to be cute or exactly what it was, because it's an accounting internship with a company called Young and Svelte. So when I think of something like Young and Svelte, I'm kind of thinking MLM. I'm thinking like Herbalife. I'm thinking stuff like that. So I think I would just try to explain a little bit what this company does, because it really just sounds like they're selling weight loss, you know, supplements or something like that. That's the vibe that I get. So if this is like an MLM murder mystery, tell me that, because that sounds great. And I would, if anybody out there has an MLM murder mystery, please send it to me. So yeah, I would say the hook overall is great, right? Like, you know, this young woman starting off her life, you know, thinks she's on her way. And then the mom finds out, you know, something sinister has happened. So an awesome, awesome hook. One thing I think that Cece nailed was the whole, like, who is actually doing the killing? Because a company can't really kill somebody, like a single person. I mean, we can get dramatic here and say it was multiple people, but like in the queer letter, it says goes after the daughter's killers, plural. Again, how does she know there's more than one killer? Or if we're saying like the company itself is doing the killing, I just think we need to nail that down a little bit more. To me, it suggested that the author obviously knows more than the reader, and they're either leading or not being careful enough with their language. So either way, we need to be a little bit more particular about that. And then for the comp, it says the motion picture, Eye for an Eye. Motion picture sounds a little stilted, so just call it film or movie. And then, yeah, I think Reconstructing Amelia is a great comp. It's a little getting a little bit older, but like it's again a cornerstone of that genre. So I think that's great. I think the author bio, kind of the writer's bit, was great. I also like, you know, red wine and chocolate as my antioxidant. So I think that was lovely. And I think it's a really strong start if we just kind of get a new title and do a little tinkering.
Cece? These are strong pages. Here are my notes. I would, very simple thing, but I would just include the year right at the top, because it does start with her like confessing to a priest. And I mean, I don't know what this says about me, but I don't quite see this happening as often as perhaps we did maybe many years ago. So I don't know. I didn't know where we were in time. And I guess just adding 2017 to the top would make sense, because she does explain that later towards the end of the pages. And it felt a little like unnatural. So just add Florida 2017. Like, that's all you need to do at the top. It's a really easy and simple device to make that clear. My thoughts as I was reading this is that there's a lot of info dumping in the dialogue. Given that he's her priest, like for the listener, she's essentially confessing that she's going to, the first line is great. It's, forgive me, Father, for I intend to sin. And then she basically tells the priest that she's going to go after her daughter's killers, because she got a letter from her daughter with a key to a safety deposit box. And she's convinced that her daughter was murdered, and as opposed to committed suicide. I don't know if saying committed is right, but her daughter did not kill herself. Her daughter was murdered, according to her mom. But like, if this person is her priest, and she seems very devout, he knows a whole bunch of things already. Like, there's a line that where she says, "How can you even ask me that, Father? You're not hearing me. Bill and I tried for decades to have a child. I was 42 when Julie was born. She was a gift from God, and they took her from me." And she goes on, like, he already knows this. I'm convinced he knows this. He's her priest. She confesses every Sunday, I'm assuming, probably even sometimes even more often.
And also just on that, priests are not like hairdressers, because you will go to the same hairdresser 10 times in a row, and every time they'll ask you what the hell you do and the same questions. And I feel like a priest is not going to make these same mistakes. Carry on, Cece.
No, it's true. I agree. And like, he, this is like obviously a close relationship, right? Like, so he knows this. There's just a lot of repetition. Like, he keeps telling her that if you kill these people, you're no better than them. And of course the priest would say this. And of course he would say it more than once in real life, but see, in dialogue, in a book, it's not supposed to be exactly like in real life. In real life, we use filler words a lot more often. In real life, we repeat ourselves a lot more often. So it's a little, it sounds unnatural and a little tedious to repeat the same thing over and over again, to read the same thing over and over again. Another example of the info dumping is when the priest says, "I've known you for a long time, B. I married you and Bill all those years ago, and I baptized Julie." Like, why would he say that? It just doesn't sound natural. But like, enough about the info dumping. I did think that, like, she mentioned that this is Beatrice referring to Julie. She also sent me an index card with a safety deposit box key taped to it. "Don't you get it? I know what it looks like, but this is no suicide." Here's the thing. Has she gone to the box? I'm sorry. You get a safety deposit key, like, you go to the box right away. You don't go to the priest first. And if you do, because maybe that's your character, then start with that, right? Like, maybe the scene should start with her saying, "I like the line, so keep the line." But then instead of starting the scene in the way she's currently starting, maybe it could begin with her confessing that she received a letter. It would make sense for her to update the priest, right? Since she talks to her priest all the time, he's someone she trusts and whose counsel she relies on. And then slowly, with no info dump, which means like interspersing the dialogue with narration, we'd understand the context of the letter. We'd understand that her daughter died, that everyone thinks it was a suicide, which means she can't be buried on sacred ground, which is a big deal for Beatrice. But Beatrice is convinced it's a suicide. And at one point, the priest could ask her gently, like, "But why is that a sin? Because you getting a letter and being convinced that it was a murder isn't a sin." And then she could confess her intentions. And that would be more impactful, right? Like, that would be like more like, dun-dun, I'm going to go after them. I do want to say also, as another plot issue, I don't get why she thinks the company murdered them. If there was something in that note that said, "These people are not who they claim to be. There's something sinister going on here," kind of like John Grisham, The Firm, then we need to note that explicitly. Because the whole, like, "There's a note, I'm convinced the company murdered her." Like, to Carly's point, a company does not have hands or legs. They can't actually murder someone, right? Like, so I think that we need more clarity there. It's just, she's sounding like she's making a lot of assumptions. And I don't think that's the intention. I think the intention is for us to be invested in her theory so we can believe that with her and go on that journey. I will also add that even though, like I'm saying, there's info dump and I need more clarity, there's like a lot of good stuff here. There's a lot of powerful themes. Crisis of faith can be a very interesting moment in someone's life, a good place to start. We feel for a character who's going through that. It's an interesting set of plot-wise too, right? Like, I want to go to that safety deposit box. I want to see what's inside. I want to understand like what happened to Julie in that internship. So there's a lot to work here. I do think that it's about figuring out the exact entry point.
Perfect. Thanks, Cece. Carly?
Yeah, I agree. I think the crisis of faith thing is very interesting. And I think the concern for a religious mother that their child might not be buried in sacred ground is very strong. So I think that's excellent. There was one line that I found that I thought was really beautiful, that the priest, you know, the mother's explaining all these problems and the priest says, "If Julie was murdered, God knows it." I thought that was so beautiful. And just like for any parent that has lost a child, just to know that, like, I don't know, God is so loving and all-knowing, and that even if it was a murder, God would have known, therefore God would not hold the child in contempt for suicide. I don't know, I thought that was so beautiful. And the next line says, "He saw his son murdered too, remember?" Anyway, just from a religious point of view, in terms of like contextualizing that in a modern context, and in the example of suicide versus murder, I think that was really beautiful. And I just really loved that line. I thought that was very insightful. So I can see how this book is going to be juxtaposing that whole theme, which I think is beautiful. So now I'm kind of coming back to the whole tone of this project. So are we supposed to believe that Beatrice is trustworthy? You know, we don't know that for sure. And especially a quote unquote, I hate this word, but like hysterical mother put in this impossible situation. Yeah, I don't know. I just wasn't sure. Are we supposed to trust her? her? Is she supposed to be reliable or unreliable? Is this supposed to be serious or funny? Like, I didn't really love the opening line, "Bless me, Father, for I intend to sin." It felt very like, I'm not sure if it's supposed to be funny, if it's supposed to be serious. It felt very kind of just trying to start the book in the right place, but ultimately didn't really feel like it was starting the book in the right place for me because, yeah, I just couldn't really get a sense of what that tone was supposed to be. I don't know if it's supposed to be dark humor. We get into, you know, the priest saying, "What do you mean you intend to sin? What kind of sin are we talking about? I'm going to kill the people who murdered my daughter." Like, we have no context at this point. You know, we've read the query. The reader maybe has read some jacket copy, maybe not. They have no idea what's going on, you know? Like, we're put in this very, very specific situation in the confession, not knowing anything that's going on. So I think, you know, ultimately, I don't think this book has really started in the right place. I think we're grappling with some really interesting things, but to me, it just doesn't really feel like the start of the book. Number one, because so much telling has to happen. To me, that's just a sign that, you know, it's just not the right place, right? But yeah, I think there's so much interesting material. I think the, you know, the mother-daughter stuff is interesting. I think the, you know, mother, you know, seeking out her daughter's, you know, killer to the ends of the earth is extremely powerful. A lot of tension there. So yeah, I think there's a lot to work with. It's just, I don't believe we start this book in the right place. And so not reading the whole thing, it kind of makes it hard for me to help to figure out where the right place is.
Yeah. Do you think perhaps the day she gets the letter and the key or something is a better place to start?
I think standing in front of the safety deposit box would be interesting. You know, just the moment of like holding the key, because starting with like hearing your daughter's dead is not original. So you don't want to start with that. But I think having the key in your hand or asking, you know, I don't know anything about safety deposit boxes, I'll be honest. I don't know if there are banks still, but you know, you go to the bank and you're like, "Hey, teller, can you lead me to the safety deposit box?" And you know, and then they lead you there and then you kind of go through that. Like, that could be a more interesting place to start.
Well, and also there, just because it'll unfold that we will know that it's not her safety deposit box, because her uncertainty being there and her kind of having this key and, you know, being led there and being, and her hands kind of shaking as she's trying to open it will immediately let us know that there's something unusual about the situation. It's just, you know, without it being told, it'll show us that there's something unusual about the situation. Cece?
No, I agree. I think that's a great idea. Yeah, because we would be filled with tension. And also she could even like be thinking to herself that she's also holding in her hand, not just the key to God knows what, but also her daughter's last words to her, because that was the last thing her daughter told her. Like, it was via writing, but that's very powerful. It would be great if there could be like someone there with her, like the priest, so we could see that relationship, because apparently that's important to the story. But fine, that can be the second scene, right? Like, it doesn't, she could even think about, "Oh my gosh, well, I'm going to have to confess to this." I don't know, but it's a great idea to start with at the bank.
I like the priest showing up too, because wouldn't it be so interesting to see a priest and a middle-aged woman walking into a bank together? Like, that's a cinematic scene to me. I like that.
A priest and a middle-aged woman walk into a bank. I like it.
Yeah, maybe, you know, maybe she asks him to come with for emotional support, whatever the case may be, is, you know, so that would be an unusual opening and certainly intriguing. Yeah. Okay, so let us dive into the third query letter. I will read it. "Dear Miss Waters and Miss Lira, I'm seeking representation for my 78,000 word upmarket novel, The Bat Tower. Given your interest in short, punchy novels and coming-of-age stories for an adult audience, I'm hoping it will be a good fit. The Bat Tower is similar in tone to Kylie Reid's Such a Fun Age and thematically to Gabe Habash's Stephen Florida. Mitchell Zagurski tried to hang himself his senior year of high school after allegations of sexual misconduct cost him college wrestling scholarships and his longtime sweetheart. Now, a decade later, he's a reformed high school counselor and living the dream. Beachside apartment, loving girlfriend, and finalist for the prestigious Florida Social Worker of the Year Award. If he wins, he believes it will erase his teenage transgressions. But Mitchell's fate turns when he's asked to intervene in a school sexting scandal involving explicit photos leaked by a troubled teen, Gio Pompei. Angry over losing his girlfriend and the discipline handed to him by the school, Gio embarks on an attack against Mitchell. He digs up scandalous pictures pictures from Mitchell's younger days, bringing his former accusations to light and costing him his job. Humiliated and unemployed, Mitchell seeks revenge. Posing as an interested homebuyer, he romances Gio's realtor mother, but when she becomes pregnant, Mitchell is forced to confront his past and the man he has become. If he doesn't, he risks losing any chance of resurrecting his career and the picture-perfect life he thought he had built. I live in Chicago with my wife and two kids and work as an adolescent psychologist. My short story collection, Book X, was published by X Press under a pseudonym X. I've done readings across Chicago at Powell's, City Lit, Volumes Books, and elsewhere. My sample pages are below. Thank you for your time and consideration. I look forward to hearing from you. Sincerely, Steve. All right, Carly, do you want to open with what you think of that query letter?
Absolutely. I will say that every editor tells me that they want a book like Kylie Reid's Such a Fun Age. It's a very popular editor comp right now. And so obviously it's a fantastic book for a good reason. So everybody is looking for this type of thing. So that's a really spot on comp for the market right now. I'm a little bit confused about the title. I assume, you know, the Bat Tower. I think that will explain things later on. I don't know if this is a reference to Batman or what exactly that is alluding to, but yeah, raised a little bit of a, I wonder about that kind of in my mind. I really like that we're tackling a very modern and complicated dilemma. I think this is hard to do and do well. So I'm so happy to kind of see this because again, I think it's very modern and realistic and very important. The only thing I will say is I would go through this middle paragraph and just check like the he's and the names and things like that, because we have Gio and Mitchell and we're talking about like everybody's girlfriends and things like that. So I was just a bit confused sometimes about like which he we're talking about and which girlfriend we're talking about, because the girlfriends don't have names and you don't need to name everybody in a theory, but just kind of make it clear who the he's are in there. I was also confused about, I think this is alluding to it, but it says posing as an interested homebuyer, he romances Gio's realtor mother. But when she becomes pregnant, Mitchell is forced by his past. It doesn't say that Mitchell impregnates her. Like, it doesn't say that they have sex. It says she becomes pregnant, as if like, I don't know, immaculate conception, or like, how does a woman become pregnant? I don't know. Is Gio's mother like married? Like, how does this woman become pregnant is my question. Ultimately, I feel like we're tackling so many interesting things in this, but I'm kind of wondering like where the uplifting moment is happening, especially in a type of like upmarket novel. Upmarket means, you know, commercial, but also literary, right? Like that's the point. Upmarket lives in the middle. And so if you're going to go in a more literary direction, it could mean like we are having an open-ended ending. But in order to capitalize on that sweet spot of what upmarket means, it does mean that we have to have an ending that feels complete with a sense of closure, even if it's not happy. And so I would like to see this like trend a little bit upwards in terms of a positive, alluding to some sort of positive ending. Because right now it just seems like he's got a vendetta and he might lose it. And so what, you know, it just is seeming like a little bit downer, very interesting, but like a little bit of a downer. And I would just kind of love to see that swing up a little bit in terms of what we're working towards and why we want to hang on with this guy for so long, right? Awesome author bio paragraph. Clearly, you know, they're established and they know what they're doing. So yeah, I think it's very strong.
Awesome. Thanks, Carly. Cece, what did you think?
I just want to add that I loved Such a Fun Age as well. I feel like everyone who read that book loved that book. And yeah, I would give up chocolate to find another book like that for like a month, not forever. Okay, so here's my question about the plot. The first line of the second paragraph says that Mitchell tried to hang himself his senior year of high school after allegations of sexual misconduct cost him his college wrestling scholarship and his girlfriend, right? Like his longtime sweetheart. Question, was it the allegations that cost him that, or was it the fact that he actually did something wrong? Like, was it the misconduct itself or was it the allegations? There's another line that says the same thing. When this child digs up scandalous pictures from Mitchell's younger days, bringing his former accusations to light and costing his job. Like, my question is this, did he do it? Is he guilty of misconduct? If so, then it's not the allegations that brought him down, it's what he did. And if he didn't do it, then why is there the word reformed high school counselor? Because he doesn't need to be reformed if he's innocent, right?
Yeah, I was just going to cut in and say, I love that you're pointing on this. I totally kind of skipped over that question. And I really like that. It's also making me think that the writer is holding us at arm's length. They're not trusting us to say, to tell us the truth. And to me, that's problematic because, I don't know, we're feeling so distant from this character already from the get-go, from the very first line of the query. And so that creates a lot of distance. So I like that you pointed that out.
Can I just add in here, what happens if this is a part of the novel in that it's an unreliable narrator and he's wanting the reader the whole time to be like, did this guy do it? Did he not do it? Etc. Then would he still give that kind of feeling in his query letter, or would he be more honest with you as the agent in the query letter? Because you guys also say no spoilers. So if that is his intention, then how should that be structured?
That's a very fair question. It's something that I also consider that might be the case. I would suggest inserting us into the character's feelings. So for example, Mitchell feels like those allegations cost him his wrestling. And that way it's totally subjective. It's how the character sees it. And it's not potentially problematic wording. I agree with Carly's notes about the he's in the second paragraph. I could understand, don't get me wrong. But yeah, clarity is also always great since we read so many queries at the same time. And it's a very well-written query letter. I'm very excited to see how this is similar to Such a Fun Age.
Awesome. Okay, Carly, what did you think of those opening pages?
I thought this was really interesting. I'll read you the opening paragraph just so you guys can get a sense of what's going on. So it says, Mitchell Zagurski tried to hang himself his senior year of high school. If someone had told him, he'd be a school shrink a decade later, about to head to a breakfast in his honor for being selected as Florida's social worker of the year finalist, he would have punched that person in the face. That's how he rolled. He leaned back in his leatherette swivel chair and discreetly adjusted his crotch. We're getting a lot of information, right? We're getting, you know, a little bit of the backstory, him being reformed, punching people in the face. So clearly, like, he was aggressive in his past. I love the, like, leatherette swivel chair, just like such a classic, just like crappy high school, like not real leather chair. Clearly he's working at a public school, not a private school kind of situation, which I thought told us a lot. And he adjusted his crotch. I have some questions about this, because is it like of a sexual nature, or is it like his junk is just getting in the way and it's a hot day kind of thing? So, you know, again, it could be their intention to make us confused, but I think I would have liked to know what context we're maybe adjusting the crotch to tell me a little bit more about the crotch situation. And yeah, I think ultimately is really interesting opening here, because we have kind of a scene that we're immersed in. This guy is trying to get to his ward nomination, you know, his finalist due or whatever at their school. And he's kind of trying to get out the door. And then a girl comes in, a teenage girl, and, you know, clearly has a teen dilemma. And so right away, like, the point of him winning the award is that he is supposed to be a good social worker. And yet he can't wait to get out of this meeting with this teenager so he can go to his award ceremony to kind of escape this moment. So this juxtaposition is very interesting. And I can tell that this is a very skilled writer, that they are able to kind of create this dynamic. And again, we're only on page one here, people. Like, you know, we're doing a lot. So this is really, really, really strong. I thought that the teen speak was realistic. This is very hard to do. And this is kind of what I was suggesting in my query analysis, is that, like, tackling such a modern dilemma with teens written by an adult is really hard to do. And so this is a great example of when mentioning your job in your query is a great idea, because it says, you know, in the query letter, it said this person also is adolescent. So perfect. So we know that this person hears adolescents all the time, knows how they speak. And so I think that's really great. And I think that part is really strong. So I don't need to like every character. That is fine. But we want to spend time with this guy. And that's different. And so we have some, again, this juxtaposition of him trying to get out the door while being in this meeting. And he says he regretted that she found him. Miss 14 going on 20. So it's just showing this, like, lack of sensitivity towards the teens that he's trying to help. And so for me, it's kind of like I have my back up against him a little bit. And I would just like something in these pages that just shows us a little bit of a light bulb moment going off in terms of, like, why we're going to spend our next, you know, 300 pages with this guy. Because then what happens is I can't remember if it's principal or whatnot, kind of pops the head in and says, like, hey, you know, do you want some help? I can take care of this while you go off to your special luncheon. And then he waves it off and says no, but it seemed like out of ego, not out of wanting to help the kid. Again, so a little bit conflicted about this, but no matter what, it's great tension. We have a very clear moment where we're trying to decide what to do. We have actual plot happening. You know, we have a sexting scandal, you know, right in our opening pages. I feel like at high school, unfortunately, this probably happens every week, but you know, this is a dilemma that is captured in a really realistic, organic way. And I would look forward to how this shakes out. But for me, for my personal taste, I just would need a little bit of knowing, like, why I'm spending my time with this guy, and just hope that we're working towards a more fulfilling, not necessarily heartwarming, but like heart feeling kind of ending.
Yeah, it's important to give us something redeeming about a character, even if, you know, they do things sometimes that aren't things that we get on board with. We need to be able to see something redeeming. Cece, your thoughts?
So I think this is starting at exactly the right spot. This author absolutely nailed like the entry point of the novel. I am assuming, but I'm very confident in my assumption, that we are supposed to find this protagonist like to be an uncompassionate jerk. Great. Let's do it. Let's be unlikable. My note, which is going to sound a little weird, is I think we need to make him worse. Right now, he's like a jerk, like clearly like a jerk, but not so much of a jerk that he's totally hateful. You know, like, I just think we need to make it worse, like lean into it. I'm all for unlikable protagonists. It makes for a more interesting story. So let's do it. There's a line on the last page. He's been talking to this girl who, by the way, he didn't even bother to ask her name. That was bothering me so much. And then he realizes, like, after like a minute of talking to her, he didn't even get her name. But he's talking to the girl, right, who's going through trouble. And people walk by, a cluster of teachers went by laughing, belly full. How poetic it must have looked to them, a social worker late to his own recognition breakfast because he was busy saving a fragile student. Like, this man is a narcissist. I love it. Let's do it. I say make him worse. I say make him extra unlikable, lean into it, maybe add some inner life about the fact that he doesn't really believe this girl. Maybe he would just not believe her. Maybe he would be even more of a jerk. I don't know. Let's make him worse, because if that's the route we're going with, then let's actually do it, right? Let's not add any speed bumps. Let's just, you know,
put on the gas.
Let's pump the gas and let's do it. I would add one thing. I do agree we have to want to spend time with this person. And since I'm saying, let's make him worse, that might actually make it tricky for lots of readers. So a great way to make either an antagonist or even an unlikable protagonist immediately a little bit more likable, or at least a little bit more relatable, is to give them someone they love, right? Like, even a total psychopath usually has one person that they're protective of, that they love, they can have one person. So I would just add, and this can be like two carefully placed lines. He could have a picture of his wife whom he adores on his table, his dog, I don't know, anyone. Make him love one person. Make him be entirely devoted to one person. And he can still be a narcissist. He can still be a jerk. He can still be totally uncompassionate and selfish and just not someone who should be talking to children, and certainly not somebody who should be helping them, but that will make us feel a little bit warmer towards him. Like, I strongly believe that's a good way to go.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think anyone is real until they have an Achilles heel, right? And this, like, clearly this is a very skilled writer, and we just need to know what that Achilles heel is. And it can be really small, and we can build to it or allude to it, but something needs to be there.
Perfect. Wonderful. Thanks, Carly and Cece. We look forward to our next Books with Hooks segment next week.
We just registered my youngest kid for kindergarten. I cannot believe it. One of the tricky things about my kids being in French immersion school and not having French as a language myself is I'm honestly worried about how I'm going to assist with homework as they get bigger. They're young now, but I see it coming. We are honestly so lucky, though, to live in a city that's bilingual, and we have bilingual friends and Francophone friends. So I know it's going to be easy for our kids to pick it up. Me, on the other hand, I am worried about me. I grew up somewhere where French class was not taken seriously, and now I have to make up the difference. And that's where Rosetta Stone comes in. As the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, it really immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion, which is a proven way to learn a language. Instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals, reading stories, participating in dialogues, and other practical language skills to fast-track your ability to communicate fluently. There are no English translations in the product. You're honestly getting trained to listen, speak, read, write, and think in your new language, which is what everybody wants. Rosetta Stone users especially love the speech recognition feature. As you practice speaking, Rosetta Stone uses advanced voice recognition technology to match your audio, the audio from native speakers, and then give you feedback on how well you're pronunciating the words, so you can really hone those pronunciations. It offers 25 languages, from Spanish, French, Italian, German, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, even Dutch, Arabic, and Polish. This is the best language program because they have been an expert in the language learning field for 30 years and used by millions. Thousands of companies and government organizations use Rosetta Stone to support language training online. Of all the apps, Rosetta Stone uses the best speech recognition technology, so it compares your sound waves to those of a native speaker for better feedback to improve. They have a patented speech recognition engine called True Accent, which is built into the program. As you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronunciating words. The other language learning apps use speech recognition to detect what you said, but Rosetta Stone tells you how well you said it compared to native speakers. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Think about the cost of a one-month language course. Think about the cost of one-hour private tutoring sessions. With Rosetta Stone, you enjoy lifetime membership and accessibility on desktop or app. We have a special offer for you guys. It's 50% off. That's a lifetime access to 25 language courses on Rosetta Stone for 50% off. This is a steal. Do not put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That we want you guys to go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off, unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today. Did you know that 70% of all books are sold online via e-commerce? If you're an author wondering how you can get some of that market share, this is for you. Hi, I'm your co-host, Carly Waters, and I'm here to tell you how writers can work on their author brand to build an audience and convert those followers into book buyers. Do you ever wonder why so many authors publish their books and later say they didn't sell as many copies as they wanted? It happens over and over, and it's all over social media. Authors really think it's a them problem, but not always. They really just weren't shown the way. And I don't want you guys to launch a book and show up at book events and have two people in the chairs. I have helped clients launch books to the bestseller list for over 15 years. I have now built a 6-module, 10-hour course with all my knowledge, and that will give you the craft and book business information that you won't find anywhere else. And there's an app. Over 100 of you have already joined my new course. And writer Siobhan Moore said, I'm halfway through the course and grieving that I didn't have this information sooner. There's really nowhere else to find it. Worth every penny. Thank you, Siobhan. If you want all that info and everything that will change the course of your writing career, go to carlywaters.com/course to learn more and use discount code POD15 for the month of April at checkout. That's POD, P-O-D 15 at checkout over at carlywaters.com/course.
Just a few other things before we go into today's guest segment. CC is available for one-on-one meetings and written critiques via Manuscript Academy. You can search for that on manuscriptacademy.com, Cecilia Lira. Manuscript Academy is a year-round online writers conference, and you can make an appointment with CC for her to take a look at your first 10 pages, discuss your work, whatever the case may be is. I have various courses that will be coming up. Please go to my website, biancamaray.com, to have a look at that schedule and to make any bookings. I'll be tackling different elements of craft and doing deep dives into them over sessions that run for 3 hours. These sessions will be taped, so you will be able to watch them even if you aren't in the Eastern time zone. And then finally, we have started a Ko-fi page. There are a lot of costs associated with running a podcast, besides the time taken to do all the interviews, etc., etc. Editing and producing the podcast takes a lot of time, which is becoming increasingly difficult as our schedules get more busy. So we're now starting to get outside editing help, which can be quite costly. We don't want to be ruining the content of the podcast by advertising a whole bunch of stuff we don't believe in or putting in filler that's going to make the podcast less worth your while. So if you are able to make a donation to us there at Ko-fi, we would greatly appreciate it. You can find the link on my Twitter profile or on my Instagram page, or have a look on the website under biancamaray.com under the podcast section. Today's guest grew up in a diverse suburb of Toronto, but her favorite place in the world is the nearest bookstore or library. Her debut novel, Ayesha at Last, is a retelling of Pride and Prejudice set in the Toronto Muslim community. The novel was a Goodreads Choice Award finalist, was featured on the Today Show, and was a Cosmopolitan UK Book of the Year. Ayesha at Last has been optioned for film by Pascal Pictures. Her second novel, Hannah Khan Carries On, which has just come out, was an instant Canadian bestseller. The novel is a reimagining of You've Got Mail, set in rival halal restaurants. She writes a culture and parenting column for the Toronto Star and has written for The Atlantic. She lives in Toronto, Canada, with her husband and 2 sons, where she also teaches high school. It's my pleasure to welcome Uzma Jalaluddin. Uzma, welcome to the show. It's so wonderful to have you on it.
Thanks so much, Bianca. I'm really happy to be here.
So let's talk all things rom-com. You had your first book come out, when was it, 2 years ago?
In Canada, it came out in 2018. That was I Shot Last. And my second novel published just a couple of weeks ago, Hannah Khan Carries On, in April 2021.
And it's already hit bestseller lists. It's done phenomenally well. So congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Well, before we go into rom-com as a genre, why don't you just tell our listeners a bit more about that book for those of them who are interested in it?
For sure. Hannah Khan Carries On is, I'm pitching it as You've Got Mail, set in rival halal restaurants. And it basically follows the titular character, Hannah Khan, who is a young 24-year-old, visibly Muslim woman living in Toronto. She is part of a restaurateur family. Her family has run an Indian restaurant in the Golden Crescent neighborhood. It's a fictional neighborhood I've made up that is basically out of the east end of the city, Scarborough. And, you know, the restaurant is not doing well. Her family is in a bit of a crisis. And all of a sudden, a hipster halal restaurant opens up right across the street and presents a lot of challenge. And Hannah, of course, has other problems. She is interning at a radio station. She faces a lot of microaggressions. There's a racial attack that happens to Hannah in downtown Toronto. And she has a very inconvenient thing, which is that she's falling for the owner of the hipster halal restaurant across the street. And the feeling is very much mutual, but they're supposed to hate each other. And there's also some family that comes and visits from overseas, from India, and presents more complications. So Hannah is, you know, just facing all the problems all at once. It's a great, fun, family, hilarious romp. And I hope listeners will pick it up.
I love that, because we're always saying that writers need to torture their characters. They need to stretch them to breaking points, and then they need to throw even more stuff at them. And it sounds like you are quite sadistic when it comes to your characters. And what I also love is that the story is very clearly based in Toronto, even though it's a fictional part of Toronto, because, you know, this is the frustrating thing that as Canadian writers, we keep getting told US readers don't care about Toronto, base the story somewhere else. And this is an amazing city. It's a diverse, multicultural city. There's a lot going on. Okay, not at the moment, but there's not a lot happening anywhere in the world at the moment. But at the rest of the time, it's a wonderful city. So I love that you got to do that. Were you ever encouraged to base your stories elsewhere and you put your foot down, or was everybody really accepting of this is where you want to base your stories?
It's such a great question, because when I was a young debut writer, and way before my first novel was ever picked up for publication, this is one of the suggestions that was given to me by one of my mentors, one of my writers who said, fellow writers who said, oh no, you have to change the city. You know, you want to get that American audience, so make sure that you set it in the United States. And I just thought, but my story is so specific to place. It's so specific to Toronto. Like, I don't even know what this would look like in the United States context. And it's very specific to a particular part of Toronto, the east end of the city. And I thought it was really important. And basically what I decided was, I'm going to keep it in as Toronto. If this is a deal breaker for an editor, of course, we can have a conversation about it. But I hope that, you know, we've reached a point where we're okay with setting books somewhere other than Paris and New York. Like, there are other cities in the world. Let's explore some of the other ones. Ironically, I do think that I Shot Last might have had some difficulty getting published in the beginning as a result of that. In fact, all of the US editors that my US-based agent pitched to rejected my book. And in fact, the only person who at first stepped forward was HarperCollins Canada. So they get the last laugh, because the book did really well. And HarperCollins Canada loved that it was set in Toronto, of course, because they're a Canadian imprint of HarperCollins. And after that, they turned around and sold it to the other territories, and no one seemed to have a problem with it at that point.
Well, so, once a book's wildly successful, of course they all want to have it. But I love that you are paving the way for other Canadian writers who do want to set their stories in Toronto, and you keep getting the same advice as well.
Exactly. Yeah, I hope I have done something. And also just the fact that I do believe that, you know, when I Shot Last came out in 2018, there were quite a few books that were set in Toronto that were sort of coming out at the same time. Catherine Hernandez published her book of short stories, linked short stories, called Scarborough. You know, and there were a couple of other books as well, and they did quite well. So I hope writers listening to this can take some heart, you know, set your book where you want to set it, and you can always have a conversation later on.
Lovely. Love that. And something you said earlier as well, which is not something you're expecting to defined in a rom-com is that you have your character dealing with racism. Now, rom-coms, you know, get this reputation as being light and fluffy and it's all about the romance. And yet here you are having your character deal with the fallout of racism, which is amazing. So that again makes us realize that because something's romance doesn't mean it has to be frothy and lack depth.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. And I think this is sort of a misconception that a lot of people have about the romance genre in general. Just like other genres, the romance genre is so huge. Like it's such a wide, inclusive, mostly inclusive community. There's something for everyone. You can have, I think you mentioned on your podcast once, you could have like pornographic dinosaur love stories. You know, why not have a story that actually deals with some serious issues? And in fact, I believe in romance, there's been a real push for more inclusivity, more diversity. And of course, there's also been a pushback, but there has been a lot more writers who are emerging who are choosing to include, for instance, biracial, Black, Caribbean main characters in their historical romances. It's like, you know, just because something is set in Regency London doesn't mean that there were only white people living there at the time. That's not the case. That's not even historically accurate. And for me, as a, you know, I am the daughter of immigrants from India. My parents immigrated from India in the 1970s. I grew up in, as I said, in Scarborough. I'm a visibly Muslim woman. I wear hijab. That is such an integral part of my identity. And not talking about that, not bringing in that aspect of myself into the stories that I write, especially when I write about characters who are racialized themselves, it just seems like I would be ignoring reality. My reality might be very different from other people's, but I think that's the reason why people gravitate towards my stories. And just recently, I've had so many comments from readers who've been picking up Hanahan Carries On, and they're saying things like, you know, this is just reflecting my reality. Thank you so much for writing these stories. I think there's a real hunger for stories that are written from a diverse perspective that do present different points of view. And I'm really happy to be writing these stories because, you know, as a writer, being vulnerable on the page is sort of our job.
Completely. And it's not just important in terms of representation matters for readers seeing themselves represented on the page. It's so important for other readers who are not part of that group to understand the experience of that group. Because, you know, we say time and again that the purpose of writing is to put us in the shoes of people who we would otherwise never get to experience their experience. And I feel like literary fiction gets credit for that a lot. You know, literary fiction allows you to experience all of these different cultures and different experiences you wouldn't get to have. But it's not just literary fiction that's doing the heavy lifting there. Your book is a romantic comedy. So romance is one thing, having racialized characters in romance, but then you think the comedy element and you're going, hold on, we're dealing with racism in a rom-com, and that feels like a disconnect, but it isn't at all, because of course a story that is funny and that it has these light elements and has people falling in love can also be a story that deals with important themes.
Agreed. And in fact, I think romantic comedies in particular, they need the right balance of serious issues and comedic issues. If you just have a book that's just joke, 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 I think the reader would kind of be fatigued by the end of it. And it's so, you know, coming back to what you said earlier, I remember as a younger reader myself, I learned so much about European history just by reading historical novels. Some of them were romance, some of them were mysteries, some of them were thrillers. But even now, I feel like I learned so much about Tudor England just from reading, you know, like a historical novel, you know, Pillars of the Earth or something like that. Just what it was like, because all of these authors do, you know, research, they get into details about it. And same thing, like there's so many mystery series that are set in other countries. And I feel like I've learned so much about those countries, even though I've never visited them, simply by reading those books. So why can't genre novels be entertaining and, you know, sort of low-key educational? Not that we set out to educate people. I think ultimately the reason why, one of the wonderful things that happen to readers is that you develop a healthy sense of empathy for others, a healthy sense of compassion for other people's experiences. And that's one of the real gifts of reading. And as a writer, of course, my intention is not to you know, hit anyone over the head with really obvious social justice messages or anything like that. All I'm doing is I'm reflecting and writing the reality that I see around me. And, you know, I think any reader who is interested in a book like Hannah Hahn Carries On or Aisha at Last or any of the other diverse romances that are out there are really looking for more depth in their romance novels. And that's okay. And if you don't want to, there's dinosaur porn for you. So you're good.
Yeah, you're covered by the dinosaur porn.
and maybe that has depth too. So I don't know. I haven't read it.
Yeah, no. Full disclosure, me either. But something that you were saying earlier is so true, because as a young South African, you know, in school, we were learning about South African history and British history. We were not learning about Canadian or US history. So my first exposure to the US Civil War was Gone with the Wind.
Which, me too. Right, I read that too.
Right. And then I was like, wow, there was this whole Civil War thing going on. And that was the backdrop, but I learned so much about it as well. And like you said, I love reading sort of thrillers and mysteries and things like that and procedural novels, and reading Scandinavian procedural novels is what inspired me to go visit Scandinavia. You know, so it is, exactly. It is amazing. We should have this well-rounded experience to all corners of the earth and all kinds of all people's experience. All right. So let's talk now specifically about rom-coms. So for the listeners out there who are writing romance, who are writing rom-coms, and there's a lot, because I've recently provided a service in which anyone who wanted to join a writing group, I told them to email me and I matched them up according to genre and according to where they based. And there were tons of rom-com writers. So let's talk about like the conventions and the tropes of the genre as you see them, or perhaps the ones that you've incorporated into your own books.
Oh, yeah, for sure. First of all, I'm not going to claim to be an expert. I have written two romantic comedies, and I am very much an admirer and fan of the genre, both in the movie format as well as the book format, but I am not an expert. You know, there's so many different tropes, and I think just in general, the romance genre loves their tropes. And everyone seems to have like a favorite trope that they gravitate towards when they're reading or when they're writing. And a trope, for the listeners who don't know, is basically a repeating pattern in literature. And tropes exist across all genres, whether you're writing literary fiction all the way to fantasy, sci-fi, thriller, and definitely in the romance genre. In fact, there's a really great website. I don't know if you've heard of this, Bianca. It's called tvtropes.org. It's fantastic. I go there sometimes and there's probably 1.5 million different tropes, and they're all very specific. Like I learned what a mulligan was because of TV tropes. Anyways, some of the common romance tropes, I actually sat down and made a list when I knew that we were going to be talking. My favorite, my all-time favorite is Haters to Lovers. My first novel, Aisha at Last, is a retelling of Pride and Prejudice, but it's set in a Muslim Toronto community. And the two main characters, of course, are sort of my reimagining of Elizabeth Bennet and Mr. Darcy. And they are the classic Haters to Lovers trope. So they start off despising each other or not really liking each other, though we all know Mr. Darcy was really into Elizabeth from the beginning. But she certainly did not like him. And then they end up falling in love. Second chance romance, for sticking with the Jane Austen's theme, that's in one of my second favorite book by her, which is Persuasion. And so for whatever reason, the first time around, their love was thwarted, and then they have a second chance. And then there's just like a lot of funny, you know, types of things that are not necessarily about the book, the way the story is organized, but little thing features of romance and romantic comedies and just romance in general. So there's the trope of like the single bed, you know, you check into a hotel and there's only a single bed. There is one of the scenes that I always love in romance novels is some kind of a comfort scene. So one of the characters becomes ill.
That was in You've Got Mail. Loved that when she had all of these tissues stuck up her nose.
Yeah. I love that too. Yeah. And then, you know, the Tom Hanks character shows up with flowers and in their daisies. And she's like, oh, they're just so friendly. How did you know I love daisies? And the other character, usually the male character, can show his nurturing side, or, you know, her nurturing side. I love this. I don't know if this is a trope, but I love when at some point in the story, usually the female character, though It doesn't always have to be stands up for the other person and really defends them, possibly to their family or to other friends who are treating them badly. This happens. This is a recurring thing that happens over and over again. The fake relationship, the fake fiance, the let's just date because, you know, it's expedient for us. Some kind of a ruse that's happening that, of course, leads to love. And we see this in so many. It's such a common trope. I love it. I'm a sucker for it every single time. To All the Boys I Loved Before yes. is a great example of that.
To interrupt before you carry on. So how is it that there are these tropes and we love them so much and we love seeing them, but it doesn't feel like when we see them that it's the same old thing we're seeing over and over. So what's your advice to writers to take a trope but put a spin on it that makes it feel fresh or makes it feel like their own?
For me, it's all it comes down to character. You know, all of these tropes can seem very repetitive, very much full of stereotypical kind of patterns. And we recognize this when we read a book that just doesn't, it just falls a little off. Or we watch a movie where like, I just don't believe in these characters. I don't think there was enough work done setting up who these characters are. So for me, for instance, the trope that I used in Aisha at Last, and to a certain extent with Hannah Khan Carries On, is the haters to lovers trope. And I knew that the two main characters were going to be antagonists to each other. And what does that mean? That means that they are on the surface diametrically opposed to each other. But if you scratch below the surface, they have a lot of things in common. And then you start building your character from there. So one person is an introvert, the other person is an extrovert. Maybe one person is sunny, the other person is not. Is he a cinnamon roll, which is another trope, a very kind of swishy, soft, sweet guy? Is he a soft man? Is she a really hard, career-driven type of person? And even that is a stereotype. So scratch even below the surface. What makes them tick? What do they love? What do they hate? What are they afraid of? What is the broken piece of her which will fit with the broken piece of him? And that sounds like a sexual innuendo. I swear it is not. But the essence of the romantic comedy is there's something wrong with both of them that somehow they not that they solve each other's problems, because we're not writing codependent men or women, but they understand each other. And through that compassion and empathy that they show each other, as an audience, we feel satisfaction. There's a really great book called Writing the Romantic Comedy by Billy Murnett. And it's an old book, but it's basically about screenplays. But a friend of mine recommended it to me when I was writing Aisha at Last. It was very, very useful. So, and I think it's one of the only books out there on writing romantic comedy. So, you know, give that a listen, give that a read if you're interested.
Wonderful. So carry on with the rest of the tropes after I threw you off there.
Another example of a trope is forbidden love. So for some reason, this love is forbidden. And this is done in various ways. And this is actually done even in literary genres. You know, maybe one person is unavailable. There's familial pressure against the relationship. One person is already married. The love triangle trope has been done to death. And in fact, there's, even a love square. A friend of mine just wrote a love square where there's three guys and one girl. And it was really fun to read about. Not exactly a love square, but sort of. You know, one of the things that I think is so important in the romantic comedy, when we're thinking about structure, you know, you can have all of these tropes that you're sort of playing around with and you're sort of thinking about. But what I would recommend to listeners who want to write a rom-com or even just a romance is to really think about those key moments in your story. So the first one, of course, it's to borrow a film term, it's the meet cute, right? So where do your two protagonists meet for the very first time? How do they get to know each other? And Aisha at Last, Bianca, you know that writing a book is a really long and tedious process sometimes. It takes years. And so one of the things that I always put in my books are little jokes that are funny to me. I don't know if anyone else will find them hilarious, but I just throw them in for my own amusement. So one of the things that I did with Aisha at Last, because I knew it was going to be a Pride and Prejudice retelling, I mean, I didn't at first, but when I figured it out, was I took these two very devout Muslim characters. And I don't know if you know this, but Muslims don't drink alcohol. I mean, I'm sure there are tons of Muslims who do, but observant Muslims try to abstain from alcohol. And Khalid in particular is like a very devout, very pious Muslim, you know, long beard, skull cap, long white robe, the whole shebang. And Aisha wears hijab. I thought it'd be really funny if they met at a bar. It just made me laugh because it's like, where is the least likely place that you would find Khalid? In a bar. okay, he's going to meet the love of his life at a bar. Because like, who meets the love of their life at a bar?
and that's a major meet cute, right? For them.
Exactly. For them, it's a major meet cute. And it fits within the context of the type of story that I was writing. It's set in a very particular community. Even for those people who aren't familiar with Muslim customs, would read the book and know that Khalid is not a drinker for religious reasons. So why would he be at a bar? He was forced there. It was a work thing. It's just a hilarious meet cute. So think about, what are the ingredients? Like, put your characters in strange and awkward situations. What annoys them? Let the other person do the thing that annoys them. And you just keep digging and picking at each other, you know. And then, of course, you have the getting to know you montage, right? So think about a classic rom-com movie. How do these two characters get to know each other? What is the resistance, of course, because, you know, if you're doing enemies to lovers or whatever, what is the vehicle that puts them in each other's orbit? Because there has to be something. So in my first novel, Aisha at Last, I had two, basically Aisha and Khalid were thrown together because they were organizing an event at the mosque. And in the second case, Hannah and Aiden, they live in the same neighborhood. They are rivals. She's trying to destroy his restaurant. He's trying to figure her out. So they keep bumping into each other over and over again. And how do they ultimately break down each other's barriers? How do they, you know, what is that one thing that brings them together? And that's what the reader is really there for. Like, for me, I love romances where there's a long, slow burn. There's a lot of back and forth. There's a lot of banter. There's a lot of interaction between the two main protagonists. And I want to see them fall in love. I'm not a huge fan of another trope, which is insta-love, which is, you know, love at first sight, Romeo and Juliet, ride or die type of love. Though, of course, it is a very popular trope. I want to see them slowly falling for each other. So, you know, and then, of course, you have to throw in complications. And that goes back to just simple plotting. So what are the complications? How are the main characters' personal lives outside of their relationship going to intrude into the romance itself? Because that usually happens as well.
And that's important for all genres, is many writers write as if these characters exist in a vacuum. And that's not the case at all, because people go to work, they have family members, they have friends, etc. And that's something you need to be cognizant of as you world build this character's life. You can't just, if they have no friends, I want to know, why the hell don't they have any friends? They don't have any family. Why don't they have any family? If they don't have colleagues, why not? Because that tells me something kind of off about this kind of character. But many writers just write and they don't explain the absence of these things, and nor do they include them. So that's very important as well.
Yeah, you have to give your friend, you have to give your main characters friends, enemies, exes, an interfering mother, a supportive father, like all of these types of things ground your character and are fodder for even more development of story and character.
And just on what you said earlier, you know, when you say there's a slow burn and what finally gets their defenses down so that they get to the point where they can fall in love with each other. And for me, that's always this moment of vulnerability, which is probably why the whole getting sick trope works so well, because yes, nothing lowers our defenses like feeling awful. Because, you know, if you're feeling sick, you just can't be sparring with somebody as you have been doing, because you just don't have the strength. So it always comes down to this moment of vulnerability in which defenses come down and they're just able to be themselves with each other, all the peripheral stuff not being there as well. And that's something Cece talks about. Characters don't have to be likable. They don't have to be, you know, this or that, but they have to be moments where they are vulnerable. And that certainly plays into what you're saying now as well.
Yeah, in Hannah Khan Carries On, there's a moment of vulnerability that happens because it's a novel based in Toronto. It happens in front of the CN Tower between the two main characters, because how more Toronto is that? And that moment of vulnerability is so important, because it's when, and this is, I think, the crux of romances, and, you know, we can talk about the comedy aspect as well. You want your two main characters to see each other. They really, you know, see something and recognize something in each other that maybe some other people in their own life can't see. And that's what everyone wants. They want that person in their life who sees them for who they are and still accepts them, still loves them. You know, that's that beautiful moment where everything just clicks and you as a reader, you feel all the feels at the pit of your stomach. It's the best feeling.
Yeah.
The other thing that could happen is, all of the first act kind of setup leads to the second act. Complications are rising. There's the two main characters are falling for each other, whether they're admitting it or not. It's more fun if they don't admit it. And then, of course, this leads to the second act. And I'm using these terms loosely. It doesn't have to be a three-act structure, but oftentimes it is. The second act complication or revelation, which then leads to the revelation of some kind of a secret or some kind of, the reason why this is a fake relationship, or revealing a real vulnerability or a complication in the person's life. Oh, I'm leaving tomorrow. I have to move out, or I'm broke, or I'm not who you think I am, or whatever. And oftentimes this does lead to the end of the second act breakup. So the main characters often somehow are ripped apart, and then the rest of the third act is the reunification of the main couple. So that's generally how romances play out. The comedic aspect oftentimes in romances, from what I've noticed, is that the supporting cast kind of brings in the comedic energy, the comic energy. And that's certainly been the case for both of my books. The really funny characters are Hannah's cousin, Rashid, who comes and visits from India. He is hilarious. Everyone is now clamoring for me to write a sequel featuring him.
Isn't it amazing when the secondary characters become, more popular than the main characters? And that's also true, in a lot of films. But then at least you've done your secondary characters really well.
Yes, exactly. And in classic romance novels, oftentimes the spin-offs do involve secondary characters, right? Like the series basically follows, how the best friend now falls in love and finds love, which is great. In my case, I don't know if I will do a sequel involving Hannah's cousin Rashid. I'm not sure yet. But I can say that when you're writing and drafting your novel, it is possible to have so much comic relief with the secondary character that you don't fall into the trap that I have done in the past, and I had to go back and fix it, where the secondary character just leaps off the page so much and you just follow them down the rabbit hole. Focus on your main characters because they are where your story is living and breathing. All the secondary characters are bringing a different perspective, and they also need their own arc. But what happens sometimes is that you can become so enamored with your secondary characters that you just start ignoring your main characters. So be careful with that.
Yeah, I've done that. I find my secondary characters to be like herding cats.
Yes.
You just can't get them under control. And I also do have an awful lot of fun with them, because you can have fun with them because your main characters, you're having to torture so much.
Yes.
And they can't always be upbeat and happy when they are having, obstacle after obstacle after obstacle thrown at them. Whereas, these people on the side, they sitting there with their bag of popcorn, and they are watching this and they are loving it. So you can have a lot more fun with them. But I agree, you do need to rein them in, perhaps not in the first draft. Perhaps you can have as much fun as you want in the first draft, but certainly when it comes to editing, it's something that agents and editors will tell you, is that your secondary characters have taken over the story and you need to rein them back. So it's certainly something you need to be aware of.
Yeah.
Uzma, our time is pretty much up. We have raced through this. This has been amazing. Is there anything else that you wanted to add that we didn't perhaps get to?
I was actually thinking, this was a really good exercise for me, because I was thinking about, I'm a fan of romance novels. I'm a fan of rom-coms. I've been reading them since I was young. One thing that I want to urge writers to think about is the second act breakup and the way that the third act is kind of devoted to, reuniting the couple. I'm getting a little tired of it. That's what I realized. The inevitable breakup at the end of Act Two, or towards the last third of the book, I feel like we need to shake things up a little bit, and I would be really interested to see some creative way of maybe sidestepping it, or because the whole point of that is that you're leading up towards some kind of a crisis, right? And the couple is finally tested, and then they come through with flying colors. I don't know. I think that the romance genre is so wide, and the romantic comedy genre is just a little part of it, but it's a growing part of it. There's a lot of interest in rom-coms, whether it's from publishers or Hollywood, specifically, rom-coms that tell stories that haven't oftentimes appeared in publishing and in on the screen. I think it's time to shake things up a little bit. I don't know what that's going to look like, but I'm just throwing that out there, out into the universe. Maybe someone will get back to me about what they want. And ultimately, romances are all about the feels. So get into your feelings when you're writing these lovely stories, because we all need a little bit of hopeful optimism in our life, especially during these dark days.
Definitely. So Uzma has issued a challenge, and I can hear a whole bunch of you out there going, challenge accepted. So we look forward to seeing how you play around with that. Uzma, thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute joy chatting with you.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on, Bianca. I'm a huge fan of the show. I have subscribed.
And that's it for today's episode. If you have any questions about writing or publishing, please email me at theshitaboutwriting@gmail.com, and I'll do my best to get them answered for you. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes. Calling all memoirists. I'm so excited to let you know that I've put together an incredible all about memoir lineup for Saturday the 11th of May from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, in which 6 amazing speakers guide you through everything you need to know to write a memoir that will sell. You'll get opportunities to ask questions of best-selling memoirists while also standing a chance to have your query letter live critiqued during the webinar. To see the awesome lineup and to register, go to biancamurray.com. There's an early bird promotion for the first 50 delegates who sign up. Come and join us and get your memoir groove on. Calling all memoirists. I'm so excited to let you know that I've put together an incredible all about memoir lineup for Saturday the 11th of May from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, in which 6 amazing speakers guide you through everything you need to know to write a memoir that will sell. You'll get opportunities to ask questions of best-selling memoirists while also standing a chance to have your query letter live critiqued during the webinar. To see the awesome lineup and to register, go to biancamurray.com. There's an early bird promotion for the first 50 delegates who sign up. Come and join us and get your memoir groove on.